Thursday at 5 p.m. Eastern Time, at least 2 weeks in advance of your event date. Space is limited, so submissions are considered in the order that they are received. The Social Justice Calendar is yet another way that WPFW connects, engages, and uplifts our community as we build a better world, one broadcast at a time.
Hi, this is Tom Cole, host of G-Strings here on WPFW every Sunday morning. I and the rest of the station's volunteers and staff would like to invite you to join the WPFW Legacy Listener Circle by making a contribution to the station's future through your estate plan. There are a lot of ways to do that, through your IRA or retirement plan, by gifting us life insurance, or through your donor-advised fund. We'd be happy to have a confidential discussion with you as you consider a planned gift to the station. Please reach out to us at plannedgiving@wpfw.org or call us at 202-588-0999. Thank you for considering becoming a part of WPFW's...
At 89.3 FM, this is member-supported WPFW Washington.
Channel in Washington and all points beyond. This is Oscar Fernandez, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington, El Distrito Colombia, here on this Friday, October 29, 2024. We're also heard on latinomediacollective.com. You can find us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and today on the show, we put the spotlight on the Haitian community in the U.S. to discuss the increase of anti-Haitian sentiment during the course of the last election cycle and how the Haitian diaspora in the U.S. should fight back. And in order to do so today, we are joined today by Francois Pierre-Louis. He is a professor of political science at Queens College City University of New York. His recent article in NACLA is entitled, "The Haitian Community Needs Another March on Brooklyn Bridge." And he joins us on the show for the first time today. Welcome to the show, Professor Francois Pierre-Louis.
Thank you, Oscar, for inviting me. I'm happy to be with you.
Absolutely. And it's a pleasure to have you with us on the show today. So let's begin this conversation. Let's just commiserate our frustration, shall we say, that in spite of some extremely vile accusations towards Haitian immigrants in places like Springfield, Ohio, both Donald Trump and J.D. Vance, they still won the election. And I could tell you, Professor, that as the son of Salvadoran immigrants, I'm just as equally frustrated as many other immigrant groups in this country are with the results of the election cycle. And in fact, J.D. Vance even admitted to making up the story or portions of the story despite evidence to the contrary. However, to quote your recent article in NACLA that I just mentioned, you stated that these accusations are, quote, more than just a slur. Their comments are priming the extreme right in the United States to attack minority groups, end quote. So let's start this conversation here by asking you how these attacks on Haitian immigrants affect all minority groups, especially immigrants.
Thank you, Oscar.
I think
your listeners will forgive me if I start with a little brief history of the attack on Haitians and Haiti in general. As you know, Haiti got its independence in 1804. The only slave society that successfully fought white supremacists, especially the French, and with the success of the Haitian Revolution, that was a demise of the slavery system, in the sense that the Haitians proved to the world that this idea that there were inferior races is a myth, and that black people were as intelligent, strong, and warriors as anybody else, and they were able to defeat the world's largest and most powerful army in 1804. As a result of that, the white supremacists never forgave Haitians and Haiti for undermining their whole system of exploitation and their whole system of how they had organized the world. As soon as the revolution was over, there was this whole narrative about Haiti, how horrible the people are. There were savages because they were killing the white men. Many of the occupiers had to flee Haiti. Some of them landed in Louisiana. Others went to Maryland. They went to the part of the United States, and they continued that narrative. Jefferson, U.S. president at that time, wrote that the U.S. should never establish diplomatic relations with Haiti because that would prove the case that black people can achieve success and undermine the whole slavery system they have. As a result of that narrative, whenever the American government and American society had a chance to attack Haiti, they always did. It's always in a way to show that Haitians are unable to take care of themselves. And in general, by that, showing that black people, people of color, are unable to take care of themselves. So during all that time that Haiti became independent, not only the U.S. did not establish diplomatic relations, recognize Haiti until after the Civil War in 1863, but also the narrative that Haitians are unable to take care of themselves was solidified with the U.S. occupation of Haiti in 1917, and they only got out of Haiti in 1934. And again, there were several other occupations, and the U.S. kept getting into Haitians' business, internal affairs. They occupied its economy. They restructured the army so that the army can be an occupying force for the American elite, and the Haitian elite wanted to establish their own businesses in Haiti. So therefore, when the idea that Haitians could not fight for themselves became the narrative for the world because they control the media and they control the other parts of the world, such as the economy, the trade, the technology, many people had grown up with the idea that Haitians are unable to do anything. But they cannot admit that Haitians were the first to really live to the true meaning of all people are equal, regardless of race, gender, national origin, because Haitians, the first constitution that Haitians created, it gave citizenship to anyone being persecuted, no matter where in the world. Whether you were slaves, former slaves, you were people being persecuted, you came to Haiti and you were given freedom. The Polish army who came, some of the Polish who came to fight with the Napoleon's army, when they got to Haiti, they realized what the Haitians were doing. They turned around and began to support the Haitians. As a result of that, Dessalines was one of the emperors who liberated Haiti, created two communities in Haiti that were given land. The poor were given land, they were given territory, they were treated as citizens, and their descendants are still living in those towns in Haiti, one in the south, one in the north. So therefore, Haiti has always been the beacon of liberty and freedom since its independence. But, you know, when you attack an enemy like we did regarding white supremacy, then the whole white supremacy structure, whether it is in the United States, whether it is in Europe, cannot admit that the Haitians are one and liberated themselves and freed the empire from the exploitation that was taking place, you know, human exploitation. So that's why this whole narrative still exists, and Haitians have been resilient, have resisted it, have fought it in various ways. For example, during the American occupation, you had guerrillas that were formed to fight against the occupation because they did not like the Marines coming into Haiti. In other places, they organized, they mobilized, they created infrastructure to always resist. And the attack on Haitians, really, is the fact that they're trying to break the culture. They're trying to change your history. They're trying to forget Haiti as what it was, as what it is today. Because once you've forgotten your history, once you have a different narrative, then they can get rid of you. They have done that with other civilizations. They have done that with other ethnic groups. So Haiti, I wouldn't be surprised that that's their intention, especially these days when we see that Florida, they want to talk about slavery as it was a terrible system.
Yeah.
Right now in Florida, they're removing social studies as a core curriculum in the core curriculum in the schools and the colleges. And secondly, all over, they're trying to rewrite history so that they don't take the blame for putting the world in this chaotic situation that we are living in today.
Thank you for that nuanced analysis of Haitian history, especially under the magnifying glass of U.S. imperialism, as you mentioned, because over the years, we've done several shows here highlighting all sorts of Haitian politics or Haitian moments in history. And we've also had numerous Haitian guests during the course of those years. And almost every single one, independent of one another, have mentioned almost the same thing that you've mentioned, which is that this U.S. perception of Haitians unable to take care of themselves, you know, has little to do with this perception of bad democratic genes, but everything to do with U.S. imperialism. And it could be easily be applied to any other country in the Western Hemisphere as well. This perception is as old as Haitian independence itself. And we should also point out that we could also make this criticism of the United States and apply it to France as well, and perhaps to a lesser degree, Canada over the years. Now, I want to go to the issue of recent events, particularly the election cycle, because while Trump's rhetoric towards all immigrants certainly give us cause for concern, to a certain degree, some of what he has proposed is neither new nor original when it comes to the U.S. treatment of Haitian refugees over the years. You sort of alluded to that already. So, for example, can you tell us about the U.S. treatment of Haitian refugees in places like South Florida, which you just mentioned, back in the 1970s and even during the Reagan administration in the 80s, that eventually led to the development of Guantanamo Bay in Cuba?
Yes.
As a detention camp.
When the Haitians were fleeing the repressive Duvalier regime in the 1970s and 80s, the American government was giving asylum to people fleeing the Soviet Union, people fleeing the Castro regime, All of them were presenting the same cases that Haitians in Obovadi. For example, you have an authoritarian regime. You have been persecuted because of your political viewpoint. You are seeking asylum because that's part of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, that you have the right to seek asylum in another country if you have been persecuted and your life is in danger in your home country. So the Haitians were given a separate treatment compared to everybody else who were fleeing their oppressive regime in their own country. Whereas the Cubans or the people from the former Soviet Union were automatically given asylum, given support, financial aid, and helped them restore, reorganize themselves in the U.S. Haitians, they were put in jail and prison in camps in Puerto Rico, at Coom, at the detention center in South Florida. And the whole strategy was to prevent them from coming to the U.S. and intimidate them so that they can be sent back to Haiti under the brutal Duvalier regime. Again, why was Haitian given a separate treatment, different treatment than the others? First, because of Haiti's history. Secondly, because they were black. This is true. They did not want any black people going into South Florida, other parts of the United States, because we know how racism exists in the United States, and racism is still very strong. Secondly, the U.S. government was supporting the authoritarian regime, the dictatorship in Haiti. So therefore, if they were accepting the Haitians here, that would undermine all the logic of supporting a dictator in Haiti. And third, knowing full well the history of Haitians, their resiliency, the capacity of them to organize themselves and show what they can prove. So it was always a question of using Haitians as a lesson to any other country in the world who would define us. If we treat Haitians so badly because they define us, other countries might not want to do the same thing because they don't want to be like Haitians. In fact, when in Guadeloupe and Martinique, when they were fighting for their own independence against the French, one of the arguments the French government used to tell them, the revolutionaries in Martinique, the progressive groups in Martinique and Guadeloupe, you guys want to be like Haiti. If you fight us, we're going to make sure we crush you. We're going to make sure that your society doesn't exist, doesn't improve, doesn't provide for its own population. And you will always be the ones that everyone would be treated badly. So this is why they kept Haitians in jail at Coom, at the Brooklyn Navy Yard, in Puerto Rico, and eventually in Guantanamo. Because that was a systematic way of preventing Haitians from assuming their full freedom and enjoying their human rights.
I'm glad that you mentioned that as well, because I want to expand a little bit more on the treatment of Haitians during the 1980s, because just last week on the show here, we had a whole discussion with regards to how a new Trump administration is going to affect the LGBTQ community here in the United States. And on top of that, all the homophobia and transphobia during the course of this election cycle, which was equally as bad as the anti-Haitian discrimination that we saw during this election cycle as well. And it's quite astounding because on top of the denial of asylum for Haitian refugees, among others during this time period, Haitians also had to confront the issue of being exclusively and unfairly linked to the AIDS epidemic in the 1980s. This sort of institutional discrimination under the veil of public health has happened in the U.S. before. So for example, back in 1917, during the Spanish flu epidemic, the Bath riots in El Paso, Texas, served as a dark example of public health being used against the public and with deadly consequences. Even in recent times, the implementation of Title 42 to prevent migrants from entering the country during the COVID pandemic has been used by both the Trump and Biden administrations. Could you tell us about the demonization of Haitian immigrants by the Center for Disease Control in the 1980s, including the fact that the Reagan administration never publicly addressed the issue of AIDS itself until 1987. This is also an issue that you pointed out in your NACLA article, correct?
Yes. In fact, when you look at it, what really happened is the same narrative that they kept on using. AIDS, there were more Americans who had AIDS, HIV AIDS, than Haitians, than any other group. AIDS did not originate from Haiti. And besides, when you have tourism, you have people traveling everywhere. AIDS was also prevalent in other places in the Caribbean. Now, why did you selectively pick Haitians to label them as HIV carriers? And then by labeling them like this, you automatically discriminate against them because many of those people were working here as service workers, healthcare workers, maids. They were fired because no one would like to invite and alert someone who is so close to them and their family to work in their household. So during that period, a lot of Haitians lost their livelihood, their jobs. The second thing also, the minute you stigmatize a group like this, you create a whole legacy of problems for the young children that are going to school. They are being picked on, accused of being HIV carrier. They cannot give blood. They are openly being discriminated against. And this created a whole kind of psychological impact on these young people. And secondly, you know, although we officially, the U.S., didn't have laws against discrimination, the minute you label someone or a group of people like that, you know that we are going to be discriminated against, even if the person doesn't say it, but their behavior, the way they treated them, would already be said as something. So therefore, by already putting this, and even when the science proved to CDC that there's no such thing, Haitians were not the carrier of HIV as a group compared to other groups, and that the level of illness in Haiti was comparable, even less than what was happening in the United States, the CDC refused to lift the ban. The CDC refused to change its position. Why? Because it fit the whole pattern of singling out Haitians and showing that, you know, if you are Haitians, all the bad things can happen to you. Not saying clearly, we are going to let other people know bad things can happen to you because you dare to define us. If you had stayed quietly and suffered slavery for another century or so, you wouldn't have that issue. So the fact that you define us, the fact that you rebel against us, you undermine our whole notion of white supremacy, we're going to do as much as possible to make you suffer. So as a result, many people, Haitian immigrants here, lost their jobs. They couldn't find work. Young people were discriminated against. Even, you know, if you're a professional, you apply for a job and you are Haitian, you couldn't find a job. And thirdly, economically, it devastated the whole community in Brooklyn and New York City and other places, but also in Haiti, because the minute you are a Haitian immigrant and you cannot work, that means you are unable to send any support to your family in Haiti.
That's right.
So these are the real repercussions all over, not only in the U.S., but also in Haiti. And besides, you know, the fact that they label Haitians as HIV carrier, they undermine the whole tourism sector. No tourist would go to Haiti anymore. Haiti, around that time they labeled Haitians as HIV carrier, Haiti has one of the best tourism programs in the Caribbean. Other countries would come to Haiti to see how the tourism industry work in Haiti and try to copy what existed in Haiti. In fact, Bill Clinton, many other people went to Haiti for their honeymoon. They went there for vacation. They shot many movies there. By the 1980s, after they've labeled Haiti as such, all this dried out. Haiti, the economy began to really go down. And this is what created the whole economic conditions that we are living today. Because when the tourism sector dried out, all the industries that were linked with the tourism sector also dried out. Airlines that were coming, ships that were coming on a regular basis, cruise ships, other activities dried out. The hotels no longer welcome guests. So the whole economy that was based on tourism went down. So therefore, it wasn't only labor negotiations, but you destroyed the country, you destroyed the population, and you destroyed the self-esteem of a whole group. And it took years for Haitians to rebuild what they had done, the damage that this labeling had done to them.
And correct me if I'm wrong, it wasn't just the CDC during this time period as well, but also the Food and Drug Administration, the FDA. And this sort of gives me the opportunity to reiterate something I said at the beginning of the show, which is that as vile as what we heard during the course of this election cycle, not only from Donald Trump, but various other Republican lawmakers, is neither new or original. This demonization of the Haitian diaspora, both in Haiti itself, but also here in the United States. But yes, correct me if I'm wrong, that the FDA was also culpable during the same time period, correct?
Officially, once the CDC has put out a statement like that, obviously FDA, which is controlled the Food and Drug Administration, Haiti used to export food to the U.S. Mangoes, fruits, vegetables, right? Meat. Haiti has a very active and productive meat packing around those times.
Tyson Foods has a plant in Haiti, correct?
Yes. They used to have all of these things. All these things dried out. The Johnson, Lyndon Johnson family, had in meat processing in Haiti. Other U.S. companies had factories in Haiti. Many of those factories closed down. So it was every branch in the Haitian economy was affected by this. And obviously no one was going to eat food coming from Haiti when the CDC kept saying these people are HIV carrier. Especially at a time when we knew that the HIV AIDS was transmitted through blood, but no one knew exactly the science of it like we know today. So therefore, something that was unknown to you, you would be scared of anything that's coming out from that country. So basically, we are suffering today the chaos, the anarchy, the lack of governance that we are suffering in Haiti, started primarily with this labeling of Haitians as HIV carrier that completely destroyed the country's economy.
Yeah. And as we have this conversation with Professor Francois, it dawns on me that we probably should have an hour-long conversation on the CDC alone with regards to its demonization of Haitians. Because come to think of it, there are very few examples of organizations like the CDC and the FDA, which conventional wisdom would have us think that they are rather benign, apolitical organizations. But in reality, history has shown us that there are rare examples like these that deserve a much more nuanced understanding, because it does affect Haitian society, whether it be in Haiti itself or the Haitian diaspora, even today. And so with that said, we're going to take a break right here. We're speaking with Francois Pierre-Louis. He's a professor of political science at Queens College City University of New York. His recent article in NACLA is entitled, "The Haitian Community Needs Another March on Brooklyn Bridge." This is the Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. We're going to take a quick break right here. Back with more in a minute. Stay tuned.
Yeah.
That was Les Leopards, and you're listening to Latino Media Collective here on WPFW 89.3 FM, Washington. Reminding everyone, you can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com. You can also follow us on Twitter under the name at LMC underscore show. That is at LMC underscore show. And of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez, and we are joined on the show today by Professor Francois Pierre-Louis, who is a professor of political science at Queens College City University of New York. His recent article in NACLA is entitled, "The Haitian Community Needs Another March on Brooklyn Bridge." So I keep mentioning the title of your article, and before you answer the next question, I just want to let the audience know that we are going to create a link on our Twitter account to Professor Francois' article so people can learn more about this fascinating story. Chief among it is the Brooklyn Bridge protests. Now, considering everything that we've discussed up to this point, could you bring all these things together and explain to us what was the Brooklyn Bridge protests of 1990? Not too many people know about it outside of New York, outside of the Haitian community in New York, but please enlighten us about what this was and how it ties to what we discussed before the break with regards to both the CDC and the FDA.
Brooklyn Bridge, on April 20th, 1990, over 100,000 Haitian Americans and progressives who had asked the CDC to remove Haitians as HIV carrier. Since 1980, there was demonstration. There were demonstrations all over in Brooklyn, in Washington, D.C., letter writing, campaigns, meeting with public officials to tell them how devastating this kind of labeling was for Haitians and how it was destroying the Haitian community. No one listened to the Haitian community. In fact, they didn't recognize that there was a Haitian American community in Brooklyn that was strong, viable. Because after all, you know, you were a minority, you were black, you didn't have much clout, and many of the Haitians around that time were not U.S. citizens, so therefore they could not have much impact on elected officials. Usually when they you know, support Haitians, they did out of humanitarian reasons, not so much out of political reasons, because Haitians have no voice. But by 1990, remember, Haitians began to come to the U.S. In the 1960s. So by 1990, you begin to have a second generation of Haitian Americans. And these people are Americans. They are savvy. They've gone to school. They know how the political system works. And they realize, you know, if they don't want to listen to you, your voice can be very loud. Protests can be very good, effective way to bring attention to issues that they didn't care about. So in 1990, hundreds of organizations came together, Haitian Americans, primarily, the Haitian community. On that day, people took a day off. They brought their children, as young as 6 years old, as old as, you know, 20, 25 years old. They bring their mother, their grandmother, their parents, anyone who was angry about what was taking place against the Haitians. They said, today we're going to show who we are. We are in New York City. We work in the city. We do the jobs that they don't want to do sometimes. We work hard, we pay taxes, therefore we need to be recognized. So Brooklyn Bridge is a symbol, one of the biggest symbols in New York, when you want to bring attention to the powers in New York. For example, Brooklyn Bridge links Brooklyn, the borough of Brooklyn, with Manhattan. And where it ends in Manhattan is right on Wall Street, where the business sector is. Well, you know, when you live in a capitalist economy, in a capitalist society, if you really want to bring attention to what is bothering you, you have to really talk with the business community, because no businessman wants to lose money. The minute you can bring that attention, they're going to do something. So on that day, Haitians began to march early in the morning. By 3 o'clock, there were 100,000 solid on Brooklyn Bridge, and they block traffic. Businessmen, cars, transportation, anything couldn't move downtown. It was totally blocked. You couldn't get to the airport because you had to use the bridge to go to the airport. You couldn't go out to Long Island because you have to use the bridge to get on the other side of the island to go to Long Island, where a lot of the rich and wealthy people live. You couldn't go up to Westchester because you have to use the highway to get there. So suddenly, that's when the New York Times began to realize, how come we had all these people in New York and we didn't know they existed? You know, other newspapers began to talk about it. Television programs began to talk about it. Other institutions, the mayor's office, other places that technically neglected the Haitians, they care about that. Realize that if you have 100,000 people on a working day protesting this, that means you have a lot more besides the 100,000 people. So pretty soon after the march, that's when the CDC decided to lift the ban and remove Haitians as HIV carriers and allow them to give blood and not mentioning Haiti every time they talk about HIV AIDS. The reason I said we need another Brooklyn Bridge is because we see what happened in the 1990s. Is there something that is happening now? When the Vance and Trump began to accusations of eating people's dogs and cats, you know, you might think it was an electoral call, something to bring out. No, it was preparing, as I said before, the context, because given the nature of the United States, how people sometimes treat their dogs and their cats better than the average human being. Now, if you know that there is an ethnic group abusing pets, and now you are given order to go out with your gun or going out there and inflict violence on these people, you would do it because you love your pets more than these people doing these things. Not only that, but the minute you create this desensitized people, you know, another human beings. And the minute you disabilitize people around other human beings, you open the door for violence. You, because they are the other.
Yeah.
You're not killing a human being, you're killing the other. The other is the unknown, is the monster, is the one that is causing harm. So therefore you are free then. And I think the danger of it is that they have targeted Haitians. But Haitians is the symbol not only of resistance, but of people of color rising up. How do you distinguish a Haitian from an African American? You cannot. Unless you ask that person for his name, you see his identity, you're not going to waste that time. Haitians live in African American neighborhoods, in places where other people from the Caribbean, people from Latin America live. So if you begin to inflict pain and you begin to create conditions to kill them, other people will be affected. So you create that situation and you begin to make every minority in the United States, it doesn't matter whether you are documented or undocumented, whether you are, you know, born here, if you are a minority, you have to feel. Because when that begins to happen, they won't distinguish between you and the others. And the reasons I want to do with Haiti, because they have the narrative on Haiti with Haitians, has been so old, has been taught in books, in history books, by historians, that, you know, people have been used to the fact that we can do these things to Haitians. We can try to break their resistance. Now, people might say, oh, it's because Haitians might look at the weakest in the chain. That's why they might do that to Haitians. No, it's not because Haitians are the weakest link. The reason they're doing that, if they break the Haitian resistance, then it's open season on everybody else. Because the minute you break one of the group that fought white supremacy, that undermined the whole structure of slavery and the exploitation system, then you can break everybody else, any other group. So that's why they are attacking Haiti. They are attacking Haitians. They're creating that form of narrative. And that's where also it's important. We need that march. Because the march that took place on April 20, 1990, That wasn't a march by Haitians only. It was a march by everyone who felt threatened by this CDC, you know, labeling. Therefore, you know, today, it's not only Haitians they're attacking. They're attacking anyone who would be against the kind of system they want to install in our comeback with in the United States. A system where, as they say, America for Americans, they're talking about white. Make America great again. I mean, let's keep certain people out. Whether you've been here longer than any white immigrant, whether you know your forebears came by force because they were slaves, they want to regain this country as the white supremacists said, the Nazis came and said when they went to Springfield, they want to have a country for white people. Therefore, undermining the Native Americans who came, who were there, you know, yeah. So taking the country away from them, you know, half of the U.S. was under the Spanish occupation on the western part of the U.S. So the whites were there. They already had all these people living there. So, you know, because they are black and brown, you're going to get rid of them too. So definitely what you are doing is ethnic cleansing. And if you allow them to do the ethnic cleansing, they'll sell with Haitians, and then they'll go to go under groups also. And eventually there won't be anybody to protest, to resist this kind of attack on people of color.
And this is what concerns me about that whole narrative against Haitians during the course of the election cycle, that it's not necessarily exclusive to Haitians themselves. It could be applied to any other minority or immigrant group in this country. And thank you, first of all, for giving us that history lesson on the Brooklyn Bridge protests, because what frustrates me about this whole narrative that was foisted upon Haitian immigrants during the course of this election cycle is something that you mentioned earlier, which is the fact that there are almost 1.1 million people of Haitian descent here in the U.S. You did not find any Haitian voices speaking out on CNN or MSNBC at the height of this attacks on Haitian immigrants. And so while this may not be connected to your article per se, I'm still curious to know if that frustrated you to a large degree, because the Haitian community in the U.S. has grown exponentially since the Brooklyn Bridge protests back in 1990. But despite that, it's hard, if not impossible, to get a Haitian voice to push back against this narrative in places like CNN, MSNBC, the New York Times, etc.
Yes, and you know why? Because first, they don't like the narrative. Changing the narrative is not something that fits their whole structure and their plan. They want to keep it the way it is. And secondly, it's only recently in some of the progressive media and liberal media that you see people of color being there as, you know, as pundits or people giving, you know, talking. You know, you might look at some people in MSNBC or CNN, but very few of the media give access to people of color and minorities. Because we live in a society that is very much divided on the basis of race, gender, color, and also class. And we minorities have to fight to get a seat at the table. And even when you get there, there's this whole complex as if you don't belong, right? And they make you feel that, you know, if you are there, it's like they're doing a favor for you, to you, but you're not really belonging. And you have to fight hard to stay where you are. And sometimes the fighting takes a toll on your body, on your psyche, and everything else. That's why, you know, we live in the United States, one of the richest countries in the world. Minorities are more likely to suffer from different stress-related diseases, such as diabetes, high blood pressure, you know, all these things that practically create stress, increase your stress level when you have to deal with them in an environment where you don't have, you know, they don't give you the same right as others. So it's not by accident that, you know, when something like that happens, they don't give access to. There are a lot of Haitian professors, there are a lot of Haitian journalists, For example, we take Jacqueline Charles, who works for the Miami Herald. There are other, you know, academics who do research. But very rarely you would see these people on national media to speak about the narrative on Haiti, because it doesn't fit the kind of context that they're trying to bring. So that's why, you know, public media and our radio, like yours, WPFW, I put, because otherwise a lot of people would not get the voice. For example, in New York City or Pacifica, Radio WBAI.
Yes.
Those are the alternative radio stations that allow to give the voice that of the people of the Haitian community, the immigrant community, the others that the mainstream media would not give room to speak. And I think that's the important one, that it's going to be a lot more important now than before, because there's going to be a backlash on curbing on access to the mainstream media, especially when you are in a situation that you have a regime or government coming up that is trying to undermine all the fight, the struggle that took place in the past 6 years to achieve equality for everybody in the U.S.
Yeah, we certainly can't predict what's going to happen in the next 4 years. What we can only carry as a frame of reference was the first Trump administration, and that included a ban on Muslims, the travel ban, that included the continued demonization and even family separations of migrants along the U.S.-Mexico border, among many other things. And so this is precisely why we wanted to have a voice like yours here on the show on the Latino Media Collective and on WPFW. And I just want to reiterate that we're going to create a link on our Twitter account to this article that you wrote on NACLA so people can learn more about the Brooklyn Bridge protests. Because in the 5 minutes that we have left, we don't want to look over one of the main things that you point out in your article, which is the Brooklyn Bridge protests led by Haitians, led by Haitian Americans. They challenged the CDC and the FDA, and they won. And so in the 5 minutes that we have left, I want to know if you could expand on this portion of the Brooklyn Bridge protests in your NACLA article and how the Haitian community, even today, can perhaps draw some degree of inspiration and hope from this grassroots movement that took place back in 1990. I know that as we have this conversation right now, that grassroots Haitian organizations in Ohio have sued both Trump and Vance over their comments in regards to the Haitian community in Springfield, Ohio. But again, the question remains, what can we draw from this protest almost 34 years ago as a source of inspiration and perhaps as a template to fight back on these attacks that are going to happen on almost every immigrant community here in the U.S.?
I think the first thing is to organize. Although, you know, no one expected the outcome of the elections that took place on November, but at the same time, it creates, opens up a lot of opportunities. It forces us to go back and talk to one another, to hear one another, and to organize, to identify what are the main priorities for us. I think we need to go back to this, and that's why Haitians were able to mobilize all these people, because they were in churches, they were in clubs, they were in schools, they were talking to people. We got to go back to talk to each other and to mobilize. And the word is like, you know, make them raise the awareness about their own conditions. Because many times we are so busy trying to make a living, we forget that, you know, the very reasons we cannot make a living is because they have too many issues they're given us that we cannot carry by ourselves, and we're too busy taking care of them. So we have to go back and create that opportunity, that space. The second thing is that when you come from a history of protest, a history of never accept what is given to you if you don't like it, you are bound to protest. You are bound to say no. The protest sometimes might be individualized, which doesn't have the same impact. But if you can do something collective, then it has more impact. And I think what we need to do is go back and say, okay, if the Trump administration, Trump-Vance administration, is going to rely on dividing people in order to rule and impose whatever they wanted to impose, we have to show them that we are better than that. We can come together. You know, regardless of language, regardless of color, we were all being oppressed under a situation that we don't like. And once you start protesting, other people will follow you, will join forces with you. And also those who are going to be economically affected by those protests will have to think twice before they support bad policies from the administration. So today, the good thing about the demonstration today is that we have a lot more Haitian Americans. They are savvier, more sophisticated. Many of them are occupying high positions in various local, state, and national offices. So they have some access to power that they didn't have before. And third, young Haitian Americans growing up in the U.S. will not tolerate those kind of abuses because they know their rights, because they know what they have contributed to American society. So they have equity and they have the right to ask to be treated equally, legally, because, you know, their forebears, their parents work for that, and they themselves contribute to the American society. So that's what I'm saying, you know. At the same time, there is always light at the end of the tunnel. It's all a question of how do we bring those forces together again and recreate the sense of belonging and show that we're not going to go anywhere because this is our country too, and we have a right to enjoy it like anybody else and be part of the whole equity that is given to everyone.
And you're right. I want to reiterate what you just said, is that we need to have more conversations amongst one another, which is precisely why I want to have you on the show. I said to myself, if I was ever going to approach this issue of anti-Haitian sentiment that we saw this year, I want to have a Haitian voice on the show in order to do that. And I feel like I found the right person to do that today. So we've been speaking with Francois Pierre-Louis. He's a professor of political science at Queens College, City University of New York. His recent article in NACLA is entitled, "The Haitian Community Needs Another March on Brooklyn Bridge." And once again, we're going to create a link on our Twitter account to his article so people can learn more about the Brooklyn Bridge protests. But in the meantime, Professor Francois Pierre-Louis, thank you very much for being on the show with us.
Thank you, Oscar, for welcoming me, inviting me to this great program.
Absolutely, you got it. And with that said, that is it for today's show. We want to remind everyone that you can follow us on Twitter under the name at @LMC_show. You can also follow us on latinomediacollective.com and, of course, live on WPFWFM.org. That's WPFWFM.org. Once again, this is Oscar Fernandez saying thank you very much, everyone, for listening to the show. That's it for today's show. Adios. Nos vemos. Ciao.
WPFW Local Station Board is hosting a town hall meeting on Saturday, December 7th at New Bethany Baptist Church, 1300 10th Street Northwest, Washington, D.C., from noon to 2:30 p.m. Plenty of off-street parking is available. As this will be our last town hall while at our present location, 1990 K Street Northwest, we hope that you will attend this important meeting to discuss WPFW's relocation plans, as well as other important issues facing the station. Healthy refreshments will be served. We hope to see you there.
A better future has been built by all of us right now. And the billions of small actions we take each day, acts of courage, equity, care, love, and tolerance, are all threads in a beautiful tapestry of the world we want to inhabit. Beginning on Giving Tuesday, December 3rd through the 31st, we ask you to embrace a radical generosity and donate to WPFW, a medium that has contributed so much to improve the life of so many through our music and message program. Donations can be made anytime at wpfwfm.org.